Captain Brett was looking one direction, and the wind shifted just a little and caught the rear corner of the sail, and it whipped across, hit him in the back of the head, knocks him in the water, and he drowns. Now, this Dutch girl had, they had three little kids, I think, none of them, all under four. And I'm sure her family, and maybe his, thought she'd give up this ambitious project. But I call it the tugboat Annie syndrome. The husband dies, the wife says, I can do this job. And for 50 more years she lived. She got on horseback. Oh, she got other women to take care of the babies. And she got on horseback and went around with surveyors. Let's sell a farm here. Let's sell a farm there. And she made deals with people who didn't have enough money they could pay over time. And they called her Madame Brett. Her house still stands right near Main Street in the little town of Beacon. Although there were originally two towns, the waterfall they called Matawan, because in the Delaware Indian language, Matawan means place of rushing waters. And then that town grew first. Then they put in a railroad in 1847, and now the river part, and a straight line between the two got called Main Street, and the two towns grew closer and closer and closer, till exactly 100 years ago this year, they said, this is silly to have two towns, and they became one town and called it Beacon after the mountain. Because George Washington had said, they ought to have a beacon on top of that mountain to help guide the ships. Of course, in those days, a beacon, one man had to live up there and gather dry wood, chop it, saw it, and then when nighttime came, he lit a fire, and you could see this fire miles and miles away. That's what a beacon was. 200 years ago, just a mere 200 years ago. Well, now, if we do our job right, 200 years from now, they will look back to this day when you showed people how planting gardens will bring people together.
This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight, and you're tuned to WBAI New York, and we welcome your comments with an email to rknight, R-K-N-I-G-H-T, at WBAI.org. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. This week, well, I still haven't worked out what it's going to be. I'm thinking about it, but I'm being self-indulgent. It's my 46th anniversary. Happy Beltane. Good morning. I mentioned the 46th anniversary, and indeed, it is that. I began working at WBAI as a phone volunteer in 1967, May 1st, 1967. I always thought that it was the first fund drive, but I was told since then that actually that was like our second. I think Robbie Barish told me that. So, well, Robbie Barish's information is usually pretty good, but I remember it differently, but I'll bow to him. Anyway, next week we start, as if we haven't been doing it all year, we start our fundraising drive. And this one, perhaps, not quite as scary as some of the drives that we have had with, you know, we're going off the air next week or not, although there's been scary stuff in the last week or so. Today being May 1st, or 2nd by now, also means that it is our first, the first of the month means it's rent time. And it's not so much an issue of the rent here at CCNY, where we are hosted by WHCR, Harlem Community Radio, but it's the Empire State Building. That's always the scary part. Anyway, this is very freeform. And Max, I have brought a couple of interviews with me. And I have a lot of audio. I brought a hard drive with all kinds of stuff. Let me just take a look. Ooh, here's one called Spoken Word. What do we have here? Yeah. And what I might do is open the phones and let people talk for a while. Let's see. I have a reading by Neil Gaiman. That's always good. I'm going to save up the Le Guin interview for sometime in the near future. A wonderful, wonderful, always classic story. Read by Pat Murphy, which isn't technically science fiction, but it's a wonderful story nevertheless. and a reading by Jonathan Lethem, which, as I recall, that wouldn't be a good thing because I think I would have to sit on the censor button. And who wants to hear anything that we have to censor? So that's on that drive. Otherwise, I've also brought with me on another drive. I love flash drives. They are just so darned useful. I have, from just under a year ago at the Nebula Awards, I did a whole bunch of interviews at the Nebulas. One, which I have not yet broadcast, it was actually the very first one that I did there, was a conversation with editor Gardner Dozois and writer Eileen Gunn, and also a half-hour interview with Charlie Jane Anders, who is one of the editors and chief writer at IO9, one of the most popular websites in the world, I would say. So, but I would like to take phone calls. I'd just like to hear what you have to say. I haven't had the opportunity since we moved here. And yes, Robert, I know you're there, but I'd love to hear from other people because it's a little earlier in the night. And the telephone number at WBAI is 212, this week's phone number, 212-650-5782. 212-650-5782. Should I reminisce at all about, the wonderful, interesting times, 46 years ago when I began working here, or sometime during the 70s or something like that. Anybody got questions about that era or remembrances? That would be good. And you see, now the call comes in and then it goes away. Why does it do that? If I don't get to your call, see, now I saw a call coming in, and with this not yet totally hooked up phone system we've got, I think it like moves up the line and then disappears. Oh, let's give this a try. Good morning, you're on the air.
Happy Beltane.
Happy, good Beltane to you.
Yes, well, actually, I figured I'd get this over with. I will try to... No, James, you must understand. You are...
You're one of the few people that saying James to me sounds James, good from.
Well, James, I mean, you know, I...
Well, it is my name.
Yes, I know.
But, you know, some people, they say James, Jim? And I go, ooh, when you do it, it sounds good.
Well, I... it's called teacher's complex, but that's another story. I've been trying to get rid of that for 5 years.
That's because you're a complex teacher.
Or something. At least I tried to be. I'm sorry you didn't bring any music for the day. It would have been interesting if you were going to do freeform that you might have slipped in, well, a couple of... Morris tunes.
I've got all of my music with me.
Oh, you do? Well,
I do. I mean, when I say that I brought a couple of hard drives,
You
have to understand that, you know, one of them is a 650 megabyte hard drive, and
wow.
I've got MP3. That's no big deal. That's a $60 hard drive.
Yeah, but how much materials can you get on it? Lots and lots and lots.
On MP3s? Yes. Approximately 400 or 500 hours.
No wonder Max can give away 500 hours of radio drums.
Well, that's exactly right.
Oh, yes.
That's exactly right.
Yes, well, no, actually...
Now that I'm saying that, where is my... Oh, there. Okay, there's audio, there's music.
By the way, now having been ensconced in your new digs up there...
I wouldn't say ensconced.
Well, how is it turning out? I mean, is it comfortable? Is it...
No.
No.
It's a work in progress.
Oh.
I mean, okay, do you hear? Let's both be quiet for a second, and let's. I'm going to turn up my mic,
okay.
And I'll turn up the other two mics, and let's just listen to the sound here. What do you think?
It sounds like that thrumming. Are you hitting the table and making?
No, I'm not doing a thing.
Oh.
No, what you're hearing?
What?
Now, I've got the door open. Okay.
Oh.
You're hearing there is this very high-pitched tone. It's above a 1K tone that's throughout the floor. If I close the door, it will go away. But if I close the door, and I'm the only person in here, and if, let's say, I ran out for a minute to go to the bathroom, which is approximately, 40 yards from here, and I closed the door, I'd be locked out and could take half an hour to get back in.
Oh. Well.
I mean, we are, I am sitting in a position where currently the console faces away from the guests.
Well.
I don't have any this morning, but in other words, it's a work in progress. We need to settle in. That work is being done mostly by Tony Ryan, who is spearheading this thing almost bleeping single-handedly.
You know,
is Morris Call appropriate?
Is what?
Morris Call.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, anything, well, of course, anything, of course, you play by Steel Eye would be appropriate. I mean, there are songs that, there are May Day songs that Steel Eye has done. They actually did a few Morris tunes that then took on words of their own, and of course, if you're going to sing,
well, this is Ashley Hutchings, who,
yes,
of course,
yes,
is one of the
right,
founders.
Yes. Well, yes, he had many incarnations.
If you're listening carefully, you'll hear Ashley.
Yes. One of the ballads, of course, that's appropriate for May Day is, of course, Thomas the Rhymer, because, of course, Thomas met the Elf Queen on May Day.
That's true.
Yes, among others.
Well, you know how I hate to play that song.
Oh, yeah.
The question is, do I play the 3-minute, the 6-minute, or the 12-minute version?
Whichever one you want. Whatever your favorite is. I was thinking about you earlier this evening because I dug out, you mentioned 46 years ago, I dug out the reel-to-reel tape, or at least I think I found it, of Baird Searles reading the poetry or reciting the poetry from The Lord of the Rings that he did back in the 60s.
It's not specifically Lord of the Rings. It's just poetry and songs of Middle Earth.
Oh, I thought.
And it's not Baird Searles. It's Martin Last, who's Baird's lover. It was produced by Baird.
Oh, I thought it was Baird's voice.
No. Well, actually, I think that his voice may be in part of that. But it was produced by the two of them, and it's more than 46 years ago, because they did that before I came to the station.
Oh, they did that before you came?
Yeah, that's about 1965.
It's a lovely. I have to tell you, it is.
It's
like
a little crude in the technology of it.
I know, but you know what? It's like the Council of Elrond. You don't get tired of it, and it's timeless. I mean, you could play the Council of Elrond for the next 50 years, and it still is timeless.
And I pretty much have.
Yes.
Except I no longer have a time slot long enough in which to play it.
What does it run, 102 minutes?
That's about right.
Yes. Oh, how you take something like that and chop it down to 3 minutes is that, well, we won't get into that discussion. That's another time. No, seriously.
Well, what do you do? First thing you do is you change your name to Jackson.
Oh, yes. Well,
then you add everything that you cut out of there, and you add it to The Hobbit.
Well, I know. And I gave this some thought, too. And, of course, one of my favorite topics is frame stories, of which I have, in fact, I'm staring at a whole shelf full of frame story collections, both East and West. And it occurs to me, you know, the Council of Elrond, of course, is a self-contained piece. And
that's why we chose it.
Yes, and it, to me, it is a frame story, because you think about it. It is a frame story in which other stories that are connected are told. Now,
believe me, we thought about it.
And
Baird, who was Baird knew Tolkien.
He did.
Oh, yeah, I mean, how many times have I told this story on the air of how Baird knew Tolkien and how I was on the phone with Tolkien during that production?
And that's when he told you how to pronounce Gandalf, I believe.
Pronounces, it rhymes with the word half, except
Gandalf.
He said it rhymes with half.
Oh. Yeah.
Because he had a very Midland accent, northern to Midland.
Northern to Midland, yes.
Yeah.
Well, in any case.
I think he was born in South Africa, but I'm
yes,
not sure.
He was.
Yeah.
And
he had a complex accent. He was, I mean, you could not, if you've ever listened to him read.
No, I never had that honor.
Oh, well, there is an album out.
Of him doing, oh.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
One of those Cadman recordings.
That's exactly what it is. Oh. It's music, The Road Goes Ever On, music by Donald Swann, and I'm sorry to say it's awful. It's it's operatic.
Really?
And all that.
And just to think, for a long time, for some years, you and BAI were in that same building. With Cadman and Singer.
Not same building, same office, same studio.
Office?
BAI had the we had at 505 8th Avenue, we never took off all the decals from Cadman Records there. And when somebody was going to get a razor blade and start getting those off, Rick Harris and the other people in the drama and literature department were screaming, no, you can't do that. That's Cadman Records.
Now, what's a decal again?
A decal is something you stick on a window or an airplane or something.
I see. And you and they were taking the decals off?
Somebody was going to. We didn't.
Yes. Well, you certainly were in the same building as for a while as Sing Out Magazine was. I don't know if I don't think on the same floor.
Now that I don't know about.
Oh, yes, you were. Not in the same building. And, good old Cadman. I actually...
And by the way, speaking of The Hobbit,
yes?
I still maintain that the best reading of The Hobbit ever, and this is still available, on Argo Records, Nicole Williamson, who leaves no piece of scenery unchewed. His Smaug is to die for. I mean, I'm looking forward to Benedict Cumberbatch's take on it.
Who again is Benedict Cumberbatch?
He's an actor.
Oh, okay.
He's everywhere.
Do you remember, because this had to be...
But I should move on soon, because if all I do is talk and chat, already gone.
No, you're right. And I do want to hear a bit of music, if you don't mind. So I will.
I'm playing it now.
I will say goodnight, and I will see you next Tuesday.
Yes.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, and let's see. Oh, no, it's this one. There's the music, yes. So, let's see. I still don't have an answer as to what it is I'm going to play. Now, Max, I was thinking, oh, damn, I should have brought a story to read. And it is conceivable that, let's see, now, you see, I've done this already, signed into the network here, and I might be able to get to my private online cloudy repository of where I keep a number of stories, and that's what I should have done. I should have thought, damn, should have brought some of my favorite collections of books with me, and unfortunately I didn't even bring my tablet, which is a lot easier to read than my 4.5-inch phone. Okay. Here's a possibility. I have some Murray Leinster stories. I have the complete The Silmarillion. I can get it for you wholesale. It would not be right for me to read this. There are some of these things that I've got that just wouldn't be right for me to read on the air. Because, you see, there's things like author's rights and minor issues like that. So I think we're probably going to stick to what I have recorded. And if anybody has... I'm thinking of going with that Gardner Dozois, Eileen Gunn interview, because they're wonderful. Now, those of you who are not familiar, Gardner is a writer. He's been around for years. But at one point, he took over and pretty much defined for at least 15 years Asimov's magazine. That's the name of the magazine. It wasn't owned by Isaac or anything like that. The name of the magazine is Asimov's Magazine, and Sheila's in charge of it now. But since then, he retired in order to become a writer, only to be brought back. Keep trying to get out and get brought back. He is now the acquisitions editor. I just have to hear what a song called Vandals of Hammersmith sounds like. The acquisitions editor of reprint fiction for Clark's World magazine, Neil Clark, putting out one of the best online magazines that anybody has. And they do podcasts, too, by the way, for those who like to listen. He really produces those things. Oh, yeah. If I play Cuckoo's Nest, I'll probably be having to deal with the FCC not long before that. Okay. And Eileen Gunn is simply a wonderful writer. She is not that easy to describe. But I think what we're going to do is listen to that interview. Now, let me tell you a little bit about it. A year ago, during the Nebula Awards, but first, before I do that, I have to tell you about our next reading. I'll play Thomas the Rhymer as an outro, since Robert reminded me of it, and people should really hear that. But, the Nebula Awards for the last 2 years were held in Washington, D.C., and I actually bolted down there. Let me tell you, taking Bolt is inexpensive and fun and easy, but don't sit next to the bathroom. Okay, all that aside, I spent almost the entire time recording interview after interview after interview, and it was a great deal of fun. So, I'm sorry, I'm trying to do about three things at once. So, this year, it's going to be at... I'm not going to be able to use that to get online. I'm going to have to go here, and I'm just going to tell you information from memory. This year, it's in San Jose. I can't afford to go to San Jose unless Science Fiction Writers of America wants to pay me to do it. And they were more than a little bit helpful last year in supplying space and stuff, which is actually how this interview occurred. Oh, look at that. This computer is actually online. And I can actually go and read you the information I wanted to. Okay, fine. So, the first of the interviews was held in this suite. There was a video made of this as well. But we're going to just stick to the audio portion of it. But before we do that, we have to tell you about next Tuesday's reading. It's the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. What a surprise. And we have a guest curator. It's always fun to have a guest curator. Ron Hogan, who is one of the people first responsible for bringing literary works and science fiction to online, much less the World Wide Web. Started with Beatrice.com for many years. He's now running TheHandSell.com, H-A-N-D-S-E-L-L. And he is the guest curator and host, and he is bringing us two wonderful people. One of them is Liana Renee Heber, H-I-E-L-L. B-E-R. So if you follow your German correctly, when it's I-E, it's usually pronounced E, like one would say Fried or Friedman or something like that. You wouldn't say Gary Fried. You would say Gary Fried, okay? So Liana Renee Heber is an actress, playwright, and the author of award-winning Gaslamp Fantasy. If you were listening last week, we had Ellen Datlow discussing Gaslight Fantasy in her book, Queen Victoria's Book of Spells, which is coincidentally one of the anthologies in which Liana has a story. She has the Strangely Beautiful Saga, the Magic Most Foul Saga, and the forthcoming Eterna Files, which will be from Tor Books. And, okay, and then our other reader will be Evie Manieri. Now, this is somebody you've not yet heard because she is a new voice. Her first novel is coming out called Blood's Pride. She has a degree in medieval history and theater from Wesleyan University, so I already know that Robert is going to be, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. She wrote that she lives in New York City with her husband, her daughter, a drowsy dog, and a badly spoiled parakeet. And so that's somebody new to me. That's one of the reasons I love having guest curators, because it's outreach. It's a way for me to find new people. We're going to have other new people, by the way, for the June reading. And God help me, I was talked, I should never talk to publicity people like Ellen Wright of Orbit Books, who has somebody coming in from Hawaii. So we are going to have a July reading. I was going to take July off. Maybe I'll take August off, but I suspect I can't either. Okay, so this is this coming Tuesday, May 7th. Doors open at 6:30. Admission is free. We ask for donations on your way in, but if you cannot donate, please come in anyway. I will tell you, if you do donate something on the way in, anything, a quarter, whatever, you'll get a raffle ticket. What you're going to get for the raffle, you might get a poster, you might get a book. This is something that we started 2 months ago, and people are really enjoying it. So I'm asking publishers to donate things, and so far it's been working out rather nicely. So we're going to have a raffle. But, you know, if you can't afford a donation, that doesn't matter. Admission is free. I said it, I meant it. So, where is it? Oh, I didn't mention that, did I? Well, you should know it by heart. No? It's at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, located at 138 Sullivan Street. Again, 138 Sullivan Street. That's between Houston and Prince Street. And for more information, go to my website, ourwolf.com, ourwolf.com. And if you are on Facebook, you can look up the NYRSF readings. It's the New York Review of Science Fiction, right? So it's NYRSF readings, and that's the name of the group. There's also, by the way, an Hour of the Wolf group there. If you go on Facebook and type in Hour of the Wolf, you can join that group as well. I didn't put anything on it today about tonight's show because, well, as you can tell, hadn't figured it out. Still haven't figured it out. So you know what? I'll tell you again about that reading afterward, but it is 2 a.m. already. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting for the time being at 99.5 FM. We are now setting our Wayback Machine to May 18th at 11:50 in the morning, according to my notes here. And this is unedited. This is raw footage, if you can call something that's digitally recorded audio as footage. And our guests are the fascinating, oh, and the recalcitrant, I have to say. Gardner Dozois was really like, no, I don't want to do this. And, you know, then when he finally did agree to do it, largely thanks to Eileen Gunn helping persuade him that it would be fun and that he would have a good time, well, he talked a lot, as you will hear. So, here we go.
Yeah, we are now rolling as far as digital can roll, as it were. So, but what I will do is start by slating it. Our 11 o'clock interview is now 11:50. And on Friday, May 18th, at the...
Does that mean we've gone faster than light or something?
No, actually, he's still in the elevator behind us. So, it's the 2012 Nebula Awards, and it's a gathering of real cool people, you know.
And us.
Exactly.
I can tell you're going to be like this for the whole year.
Yeah, probably so.
I can see I'm going to have to introduce you in post-production. but it's Eileen Gunn and Gardner Dozois. It has been a bleep of a long time for Gardner. Actually, well, you, I got Was it your last KGB reading or something
like
that?
Yeah, in 2004. That wasn't...
That was 2004. Yeah.
Gentleman does not boast of when he got to lady last. Keep that in mind.
Yeah, that was when my book came out, I did.
That's right.
Did your
that
show.
That was 2004?
Yep. Back when we were children.
Yes, exactly.
Well, he first interviewed me back when dinosaurs walked the Earth.
That's actually true. That tracks.
We're little mammals scurrying across the forest floor and eating their eggs, and we stopped to do a radio interview on the way.
Yeah. And one of these days, by the way, Gardner, it will happen. Now, Gardner knows what I am talking
about.
I
do know
what
you're talking
else.
About.
But I recorded...
He believes in the rapture. He keeps waiting and waiting. And
the digital rapture?
No, this was analog. This was that I recorded Gardner and Michael Swanwick,
yep,
or somebody like that.
Jack Dan, maybe.
Yes, Jack Dan, not maybe. Reading... What is it called? Afternoon Drafts?
Yeah, three collaborator story. We read it aloud at one of the old
New York Review of Science Fiction reading series. Who runs that today?
I have no idea. You live in New York. What are you asking me for?
I'm asking you because you turned me down the last time I asked you to read there, Gardner. I run it today. But not anyway.
But you forgot?
Yeah, you know, it's the senior moment. And
let me go over this. You're in Crystal City, Maryland. You're in a hotel.
I have not done Crystal in ages. Flyers for each of them, of course.
But is this what we're supposed to say here?
Yes, exactly. Anyway, that's just the current state of the reading series. That's
Gee,
all.
Jim, you sure are a brilliant interviewer.
I'm a host, I'm not an interviewer.
Damn straight, Gardner.
And as you can see, I'm
actually... Wait, let me turn the page here.
Getting...
Okay. And you are also devilishly handsome.
Read that bit. Okay, the cue card, by the way, is the one straight ahead of you.
Oh, the one that looks cleverly disguised as a lamp.
With the word that says, yes, bon vivant. At any rate, I have the world's worst filing system. I would get a cassette, I would broadcast the cassette, and unlabeled, Todd is going to have conniptions, unlabeled that cassette went into places. I now have 5 or 6 shopping bags filled with unlabeled cassettes of air checks, who knows what, and Afternoon at Shrafts. And Gardner has been wanting that recording for...
20 years?
21 years. Because that was about the 5th.
So
And I'm going to pause that, by the way, just to tell you that, believe it or not, somebody actually, Cesar Bustamante, made a movie all about my tape collection. You can see it. You can go into my house virtually and go into the basement and other parts and see the reel-to-reels and cassettes and all that need digitizing. Our Gardner's tape is buried somewhere. That's what we're talking about there. And to see that movie, I don't have the Earl with me, but I'll tell you before the show is done.
Don't hold out a lot of hope that you're going to get a tape of this.
But now, no. We're digital now. Now that we're digital, actually, everything goes like right into the... I mean, in an hour, this will be in the cloud, and then...
He also has the Lost Nixon tapes in that shopping bag.
You need a librarian. You need to just donate your tapes to a nice library, and they'll figure out what's on.
I spoke to somebody else named Gunn about that. No relation. And Jim Gunn had these students call me up, and they said... Yeah, we hear that you need some archiving done. Just send us all of your tapes. And I said, should I send my left arm along with it?
Probably that's no help in filing, I would think.
So that hasn't happened. I'm trying to get a grant.
So it's your dragon horde.
Yeah. That is my dragon.
You know, if you didn't sit on them, the tapes would be in better shape.
But or they would have hatched. So let us, the two of you have frequently, or well, occasionally collaborated as writers.
No, we haven't.
No, we haven't.
See, I told you got the wrong people.
We personally
sorry. I thought you were James Gunn, and there is nobody else, and even a Gardner or Dozois involved.
No, Eileen and I have known each other for much longer than I'm sure
neither of us
want to admit, but we have not collaborated on anything.
What was Eileen, you contacted me some years ago about doing something together with him, didn't you?
Well, what
tell me what that
Gardner
was.
Instigated.
That's why my faulty. Yeah.
Gardner instigated is what it was. Ellen Datlow was the editor at Event Horizons.
Right.
And Event Horizon.
And I worked for her at that time.
Oh, okay. And she wanted, wanted to do a series of collaborations in which people. Didn't know what was going on, and four people would collaborate on a story that they hadn't worked out anything in advance, and they would bait one another and torture one another. And she would publish this transcript of horrible relations in her website. And she had, I think, done two of them, one of which was with Susan Casper, who's Gardner's wife. And she wanted to do another, and she asked Gardner to do it, and Gardner had far too much sense to say yes.
Hell no.
I think he said, why don't you get Michael Swanwick?
Yeah, I did.
And
same thing I said to Jim downstairs, but it didn't work.
And Ellen asked me, and I said, well, I could persuade Gardner, but I couldn't persuade Gardner to join in. But he said,
you didn't have the fur bikinis.
He said, we should get together for dinner. So it was actually at a Nebula weekend that Michael Swanwick and Gardner and Susan and I got together to talk about this story that hadn't existed yet. And Susan said she desperately wanted to tell us something. And I said, what is it? And she said, you've got to plan the story out ahead of time. You can't do this when none of the writers know what's going on. It will be terrible. Trust me, because she had just done it. And although I understand the story that she did was quite good, but they had a horrible time with it. And I said, you know, my eyes got all big, and I said, but Ellen wants us to do this sequentially without us knowing what we're doing. How will we deal with that? And Susan looked me right in the eye, and she said, lie to Ellen. So Ellen may hear this, you know.
Always a good
Ellen
policy.
Knows that we lied to her.
Oh, okay, good.
We confessed later.
Didn't Pat Murphy get involved?
Yeah, Pat Murphy. We decided it was an idea that Michael had. Michael might have even been the instigator.
Actually, it was my idea.
It was your idea.
Yes,
okay.
I gave it to Michael.
Okay. Well, I don't have the memory that I had once when I was a puppy.
It's over there.
Oh, thank you. So it was your idea. That's why. And you brought Michael
into it. Well, I was watching a documentary. There should be air quotes here. Documentary. About the Philadelphia experiment, which supposedly happened at the Philadelphia Navy Yard in World War II, where they made this teleporting battleship that went into different dimensions and everything. And the thing I noticed that I don't think anybody else had ever noticed was the very same time this was supposed to be happening, Robert Heinlein, Isaac Asimov, and Elsberg de Camp were working at the Philadelphia Navy Yard. So it seemed like a natural thing to say they were responsible for the Philadelphia experiment. And that was about all I had to do with the story, actually.
And what was the Philadelphia experiment?
They supposedly put this strange teleportation device into a Navy battleship. And it made it able to teleport places, and it got hung up in strange dimensions, and the sailors were frozen, like coming half out of the steel of the wall and so forth. It's a favorite occult thing. You probably can still read articles about it to this day.
Well, there was a book on it by the guy that wrote the book on the Bermuda Triangle, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so that was a bestseller.
And there was a movie, The Philadelphia Experiment.
So we were like mining territory that people should have understood what we were doing. And, I mean, I had actually no recollection what the Philadelphia Experiment was, but I went off and read the book and did some research. But in the conversation, we thought, okay, we need four people, and we'll do point of view characters, because then your voices can be different. So we needed... Heinlein, we needed Isaac Asimov, and L. Sprague de Camp. And I thought, you know, I want this to be like two women and two guys. I don't want it to be the only woman on this. And I want a woman character in the story. So I thought about it, and I said, well, what about Grace Hopper? And as it turned out, Grace Hopper was actually, she was never stationed in Philadelphia, but she was an ensign in the Navy at the time. And of course, she's the woman who invented COBOL and who found the first computer bug.
And the nanosecond. She invented and coined the concept of the nanosecond.
And she was an admiral.
She's one of the great names in computing. I have a...
Yeah, definitely.
Well, throwing her in was your idea. That had not occurred to anybody else.
Yeah, well, I just thought there ought to be a woman in the story. But then I volunteered to do Isaac Asimov. So I did the part from Isaac Asimov's point of view. And we worked out the plot. And we worked it out in great detail. Oh, then we invited Andy Duncan, because he could do Heinlein, and he did Heinlein. And Pat Murphy did Grace Hopper. And Michael Swanwick, we thought he'd do L. Sprague de Camp. But instead he said he wanted to be the puppet master who came in every fourth segment and did whatever he wanted. He thought this would improve the story. And the rest of us kind of went along with it, you know.
My guess is
Michael Swanwick. What
he put in the giant sea turtles and the pirates.
I put in the sea turtle. He put in the pirates.
He put in the pirates, yeah. That was not
Pat,
in the original.
I think Pat put in the pirates.
Did she?
Huh. Pat is a big pirate person. But Michael, given any opportunity, he would use... whatever was it. He's a great collage artist of fiction. So he would use any little bits that we had mentioned and collage them into this spectacular thing that threw a wrench in the works every time and forced us to replot the next part of the story.
Did you stick with all writing one character?
Yeah, we did.
I remember the first time I did a three-way collaboration with Jack Dan and Michael Swanwick, we did this story called Touring, which came from an idea that I'd had about a strange Twilight Zone-ish scenario where Buddy Holly ends up performing a concert with Janis Joplin and Elvis Presley, and it's, you know, pretty obvious that, you know, they're all dead and they don't realize it. But the original plan was that we were each going to take a character. Jack was going to take Elvis because he was a big Elvis fan, and I was going to take Buddy Holly, and Michael was going to take Janis Joplin because he'd already written a story about Janis Joplin. And we were going to, you know, each write the character's viewpoint. And it didn't work. We all ended up writing from the other character's viewpoint at one point or another.
No, after the story was done, I think Michael and I each took a swipe at evening out any lumps or inconsistencies, and then ran it by the other two writers to make sure that we hadn't damaged.
Well, that's sort of what you have to do with a multi-person collaboration. You need somebody to be the lump smoosher, you know, who will make the decisions about which competing versions of a scene should stay in and which should go, and smooth the prose out. And that was usually my job in the three-way collaborations.
Well, I really enjoyed doing it. The story is called Green Fire, and it was published first in Isaac Asimov's science fiction magazine, and then it's in my short story collection, but it was published first on Ellen's site,
yeah.
Because
and
Ellen
then
Ellen
I reprinted it.
And you reprinted it.
And yeah, Event Horizon, unfortunately, there was a time when you could go into the Internet Archive and read any of Event Horizon or
mm-hmm.
Omni Magazine, any of Ellen's old stuff, and since then they put one of their, you know, robot.txt on there so that nobody can read
it. Oh, really?
It. And
that's too bad.
It's a shame. But I wonder if that story, if some of those stories are online anywhere. Asimov has a few stories online, I think.
Well,
Asimov does not have a big backlog of stuff that have been in the magazine now online. And so I tend to doubt you could find it at Asimov's.
Yeah, if it's,
who was
if
the
it's anywhere, it's been basically
time.
Pirated.
Me. It was you. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's in my
years,
short story
yeah.
collection, but that's in print.
Yeah, and that's
Stable Strategies and Others.
Say that again.
Stable Strategies and Others.
Did somebody publish that?
Tachyon published it.
Tachyon Press. That's that Jacob Weissman
yeah.
kind
it's
of guy?
It's that Jacob Weissman guy.
So one could go to Tachyon Press's website and
actually,
find out
could,
how to get that book.
You can download
they?
It, I believe, from their website. You,
you can download
informational
the, you can download the contents of the book, or you can download.
No, there's an ebook version.
The book.
There's an ebook version.
There's an ebook
yeah.
version. Okay.
And it's on Barnes & Noble, and it's on Waitlist Books. It's not on Amazon.com because Amazon is not dealing with Tachyon's distributor. And that's a different
you're
another
me.
Story entirely.
I have no idea.
Really?
Yeah, really. I've no idea.
4,500 books from IPG, Amazon, and they
are at war
disputing the contract.
All these tech companies are at war with each other, and it all bleeds over, and the writers get hurt.
And the distributor gets hurt. He's just a books distributor. He's not.
Yeah, and he's an independent book distributor.
Yeah.
So that's when it's really egregious.
Yeah, just
yeah.
a little guy.
Yeah. I know I am going to be sorry for asking this. Gardner, what do you have in print that people can read or available online?
Oh, quite a bit of stuff
I thought so.
In print.
Because I have all of your books at home.
I'm working out deals now to get some of my older Best of the Year anthologies out in ebook form.
Oh, great.
And recently they put the first two of the St. Martin's Best of the Year series out in as e-books. So now you can get one and two, and one was very hard to find for decades.
But let me just tell a lot of people are going to be hearing this on the CIFL website, but some people are going to be hearing this on the radio. And the most frequently asked question on my radio show that, besides why don't you get off the air, is either usually I used to read science fiction, I don't anymore, who should I be reading, or I don't like the sci-fi stuff, but I like what I've been hearing on your show, how do I find out? The answer is get the Best of the Year anthologies, get collections of short stories from people then, and or their novels, but starting with the Best of the Year anthologies, I think is the best way to find out what your tastes in Skiffy literature are.
Well, that was sort of the idea behind the Best of the Year in the first place, was that it would be a sampler where I would collect what I thought was the best stuff of the year. Of course, it's all subjective. You know, some other editor will think that something else was the best stuff of the year, and there's no absolutes. But I would collect stories that I liked, and the idea was that people would read these stories, and then if they liked it, like some of the stories, they could look up that author. And I always was very careful to give lists of the authors' back titles and so forth, so they could then go look up the authors. And this is becoming easier and easier all the time, as a lot of backlog stuff is coming back either into print or becoming available in ebook form. There was a time in the 80s and 90s when almost nothing that was out of print came back into print for about 15 years there, and it was almost impossible to find old titles without haunting used bookstores. But it's gotten much easier now. My whole the concept behind the best of the year was I grew up in a small little town in Massachusetts, Salem, Massachusetts, and there was no bookstore there. They had a couple of spin racks in the drugstore, and there was the only source for books. So if you wanted to go to a bookstore, you actually had to get on the Boston and Maine train and go 25 miles into Boston and to find a bookstore. And so I've always pictured the best of the year as sort of a science fiction seed. You know, it floats through the air and happens to land on some farm in Nebraska or something. And using the materials you find in the best of the year, you can, if you want, reinvent yourself as a science fiction fan, because there's the stories, so you can see, you know, what authors you like. There's information about how to subscribe to science fiction magazines. There's information about websites you can go on online that publish science fiction. There's, you know, who died, who won awards. So there's all that. That's all the information you need right there. You can unpack it, and it'll turn yourself into a science fiction fan.
There's even information on the stories that you didn't put in the book, which is enormously generous and competition-generating thing for young writers.
Aspiring writers who didn't make it into the book, they find their names under honorable mentions or whatever, and it's a thrill for them.
I must admit, I didn't expect that, and I'm always surprised when someone writes me and said, oh, thank you for putting my name in honorable mentions. You know, I didn't think that was going to happen.
You
honorable mentioned my wife. It was a thrill. It was a thrill. Barbara Krasnoff. And so she has a postcard that says, you know, Gardner knows what, and that level.
Well, you see, it's very sneaky of me, because if I put their name in the honorable mentions, then they've got to go out and buy a copy of the book, and then they've got to buy one to give to their mother.
Well, that was, yes, we bought six, as a matter of fact.
See?
One for the Bragg Show, one for the mother. It's true. So this was the evil plan all along.
Oh, of course, of course.
If you put photographs in of all the honorable mentions.
Little photographs. Actually, these days you could do like little clips of them speaking and waving and stuff. That would be even better.
Eileen, what are you writing now?
I'm writing a novel, which after... But 35 or 40 years of writing short stories.
Wow, a novel.
Is an adventure. Yeah, I'm going at it sneakily, where I write all the different parts at once. So it's just like writing six short stories, not really like writing a big scary novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't really talk about it, because it always sounds dumb when you describe a novel in three sentences. And I'm terrified that it will be dumb, so I don't talk about
not
the
so
plot
Captain is. Chases Whale.
Exactly.
And describes cleaning the whale from the inside for 50 pages.
Well, that sounds really stupid. Who'd want to read that? Oh, he bites his leg off first. Oh, a little more interesting. Not really.
How is the process different from you, from the short story process?
Well, it's scarier, and it doesn't get over as fast. I mean, for me, I can write a short story in 2 or 3 years. You know, it's not such a big deal. But a novel, I've been working on this novel for 9 months, and...
You could have had a baby by now.
Yeah, I could have. Well, not recently. But I've been working on it for 9 months, and I have about 10,000 words. It's not completely invisible. It's mm-hmm. not all in my head. And I'm blocking it out. I have to... The real difference is that I have to know the plot. With a short story, I can keep myself in suspense. I've found, you know, I've been writing for a long time, 40 years or more, and I've found that if I know the plot of a short story, I get bored and I put it aside. I think I've solved that problem, and I move on. Even though the writing process is interesting and new things are introduced, I don't like to know how it's going to end. So with a novel, and with one as complicated as the one I envision, and it's potentially troublesome, it's a novel that will deal with gender and race issues and, you know, everything that can get you into trouble.
Okay.
And people say, well, why? And I said, well, if it's not scary, why bother with it, you know? But we'll see. We'll see. It could be a disaster. You never know. But I do have to know what I'm doing. I can't, and it's a historical, so it's set in 1845. And it's got to,
back
I have to know what's
board.
Going on. It's set in a place I've never actually been. So that makes it more like science fiction and more attractive in some way.
Mm-hmm.
William Gibson never writes for most of his career, didn't write about any place he'd ever been because he felt that would destroy the magic. So all the Japan novels, when he was writing the Neuromancer, he'd never been to Japan when he wrote Neuromancer, or Johnny Mnemonic, any of the stories, the related stories.
I was just thinking of his first short story, and I'm blanking on the name, the one in Mirror Shades.
Oh, yeah.
Burning Chrome?
No.
Johnny Mnemonic. No, this is
Gernsback Continuum.
Thank you. The Gernsback Continuum. I mean, it's Arizona. You know, it's and the Rockies. Even
He had been to Arizona.
Yeah, okay. That's what I was going to. And the funny thing is, here's the book that defines cyberpunk, according to Bruce Sterling, and this is the book that defines Mirror Shades. It's not a cyberpunk or a Mirror Shades story at all. It's a wonderful story.
Well, most of what Bruce wrote wasn't cyberpunk either.
No.
But this is the cyberpunk anthology.
In fact, I always thought that Bruce was a lot more similar in his work through most of his range to Howard Waldrop than he was to Bill Gibson. I mean,
yeah, they didn't write alike.
Sterling writes a lot of like quirky historical fantasies, just like Howard does.
Yeah, okay.
And the Shaper Mechanism stories, or Shaper Mechanist stories, are about the only ones for Sterling that you could really say were cyberpunk, and maybe a few of his near future novels.
I think what he did, though, was just define a set of aesthetics that works for all the cyberpunk people and people like me who didn't quite get classified as cyberpunk. I have like one cyberpunkish story that Bruce labeled what? Kitty punk?
He's a great labeler. So how are you researching your book since it's a time and place?
Well, research is easy now. We have the internet.
Yeah.
I'm researching. I can go anywhere. I can do anything, and I can order books from all over the country. So I simply go to ABE Books, and I look up a term, a name, a place name, or something like that, and I am inundated with choices of books. So I've got stacks and stacks of very targeted books on what I'm writing about, and it's glorious. I don't have to go to every bookstore in the world. I don't have to order books through interlibrary loan that never arrive. It's a fantastic thing.
Howard was lucky with research because he would go to the university library in Austin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And sort of crawl in there and not come out for a couple of months. But most people don't have that resource to hand.
No, actually, I'm thinking of there are a few people, Richard Bowes and James Gunn, a lot of people have the access to the universities, and that's way cool. So, I was thinking, I always have this romantic notion of, well, I'm writing in Spain, so I'll get the passport and all that. Now they just have to search for it. And on the one hand, it's so much better because the access is so much easier. And on the other hand, it's so much less romantic.
On the other hand,
you can say, hey, Siri, write this book for me.
On the other hand, you don't have to run from the damn bulls.
and I can't actually go back to 1845. So at some point, I will.
You can't?
You can?
Well, yeah.
Take me along. at some point, I will have to go.
1845 is just 6:45. Oh, I'm sorry, that's military time. But
At some point, I will have to go to Missouri. I like to be places and touch things and
smell
them.
So you are actually going to do that? That would.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I have done this for other work. And sometimes I finish the story, and sometimes I haven't. But at one point, I went to Samarkand for a fantasy story that I was writing. And just because I could, because when I started to write the story, I had no idea where Samarkand was. And it turned out it was in Uzbekistan, in the Soviet Union. And
oh, I thought
just
it was in
there.
Missouri.
It's in Missouri?
Yeah, I thought so.
It's both. It's one of those little... You know,
the portal.
Exactly. You know,
but it was extremely cool. It was
TARDIS
cool to be
place.
There. And Uled Beg, who was the story was set during the reign of Uled Beg, who was a grandson of Tamerlane. He built this huge telescope that the ruins of which are still there. He was a Mongol ruler, and he was a big astronomy fan. He did a lot of the research that Tycho Brahe did 200 years later. He had already done, but the information never escaped Samarkand. It was the Dark Ages in Europe. So it was fascinating. The kind of strange little pockets of history were fascinating to me.
Gardner.
Yes.
What are you writing now?
Not much.
Bupkis.
Yeah, pretty much Bupkis. I tried to write a novel last year and found that I couldn't do it, so that was depressing. I write a short story every once in a while. Mm-hmm. I never was much of a novelist. I mean, I think I have different muscles. I'm a natural short story writer. I squeeze everything down.
And novella.
I am much more likely to squeeze 400 pages of material down into 20 pages than I am to go in the other direction.
Well, you're both really short story writers, in my mind.
And I'm basically a sprinter. I will finish a work in like 4, 5, 6 days of intensive work, but you know, to go on and on and on after that to get like 100,000 words, you know, I don't think I have the stamina for that. I've mostly been doing anthologies the last couple of years. I've been doing a bunch of big anthologies with George R. R. Martin. I think we're on our 5th or 6th one at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been taking most of my time up.
Yeah, he's been doing some TV work on the side.
So I've heard.
On the side.
Yeah, on the side, yeah.
Yeah. Hey,
I don't know if that'll ever amount to anything.
did it sitting on the throne. But no, sorry. But
Have you thought, Gardner, of breaking the story up into a bunch of separate stories? And writing each of them for your novel?
Well, that's,
either different points of view.
That's sort of what I did for the one solo novel that I managed to complete, which
is a fantastic novel.
It is.
Wrote it first as a novella, and then I unpacked it to get a novel out of it. There were scenes where I skimmed over and I made them longer.
Oh, we're talking about
compression.
This is Strangers.
Yeah.
We're talking about Strangers.
Yes.
And that worked. I haven't figured out a way to
in
do that.
Print Strangers?
No, it's long out of print.
Ah.
But it's one of the books that we're talking about putting out as an e-book sometime in the next year. So that may soon be available in e-book format.
Possibly by the time people hear this.
Possibly. Rush right out on a buying frenzy and, you know, buy several copies.
Ask for it by name.
And the other successful novel that I managed to finish was a novel I wrote with George R. R. Martin and Daniel Abraham. And that had a very strange origin in that I had started to write this novella and I couldn't finish it. And so I gave it to George and said, you know, you can finish this. And, you know, he worked on it for a while, and then he couldn't finish it either. And this whole process had taken about 20 years, by the way. It was a very long, drawn-out process. And so George turned to Daniel Abraham, who lives out there in New Mexico and was one of our Clarion West students. Mm-hmm. And as Daniel said, he took him out to dinner and said to him, "How would you like to have a three-way with two fat old men?" And Daniel said, "Sure." So he...
Was George in New Mexico at that time?
Yes. Yeah. George lives in New Mexico.
Yeah.
And so Daniel took the what we had of the material, and he actually did finish it, and finished it as a novella, and then I rewrote the novella, and then we sold the novella to Ellen and a couple other places. It came out as a chapbook, and then eventually we decided we were going to make it into a novel, and so he did the basic draft, and then George worked on it a little, and then I did a couple of drafts, and that eventually ended up being a novel called Hunter's Run, which is already out as an ebook, I believe. And it may still be in print, I'm not sure.
What are you writing now?
Not much.
Oh, I asked that already. I'm going to keep asking until you say, "Well, I'm doing a new whatever now." Are you planning on honing those, working those chops again at some point?
You know, if I live long enough, I probably will write something else. But I've never been prolific. I mean, it's an easy out for me to say that... I didn't write more because editing Asimov kept me too busy, and it's a good face-saving excuse.
That was
but
then.
The fact is that I'm not sure I would have written any more even if I hadn't been.
I don't know.
Even if I hadn't been editing Asimov's writing, has never come easy
to me. I've had nightmares
it's very slow
of some of your fiction. What is the story of the man?
Nauseated is the usual reaction.
It was in there too. The story with the fellow who's got a telepathic love interest going on. He is
a Kingdom by the Sea.
Oh God!
A Hugo finalist, didn't win, by the way, but probably just as well.
Just as well.
I thought that story had a lot of pull in it. Sorry. Well, yeah. For those who know the story, that was a pun. It's
I thought it was a palindrome.
Okay. Everybody at home, take time out. Look that up. Which is the story you read in the bar one night? Game of Night and Shadows?
The Night of Ghosts and Shadows.
The Night of Ghosts and Shadows. See, I'm just, asleep still.
My stories usually do that.
That's a great story. The stuff, to quote Spencer Tracy, there may not be much there, but what's there is Churse.
Not all there is something that's been said to me a lot too. So can
well,
appreciate
you've got,
that.
You've got two short story collections, right? Three, two,
four actually.
Four.
It depends what you count as short story collections, because I've also got two collections of my collaborative work with other writers. There's Slow Dancing Through Time, and Jack Dan did a book of his collaborations, which included a lot of mine, called The Fiction Factory. And I've also got a couple of stories in Michael Swanwick's Moon Dogs that we did in collaboration.
So you've got stories to burn. You've got stories that go into other people's collaborations
and
you don't
them.
Even swipe them back.
Let me see. My first collection was The Visible Man, and I had, after that, I had Geodesic Dreams, then I had Strange Days, which was the book they did when I was the guest of honor at the Worldcon. Nesfa Press did that. And then I did Morning Child and Other Stories. And the most recent one, which came out last year, was called When the Great Days Come. And that is still available in print and in ebook. So again, Buying Frenzy, Rush, Door, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah. No, I just remember at the very beginning of the interview, my first faux pas of the day, and there will be many more to come. When I said, Eileen, you collaborated with Gardner at some point, no, it was some other Philadelphian. That's what it was.
I've collaborated with several Philadelphians.
It was the Philadelphia experiment all over again.
Yeah, and Michael Swanwick and I have collaborated.
Well, now, Eileen and Michael have frequently collaborated, but I have not actually collaborated with Eileen.
With Michael, though, right?
Oh, I've collaborated lots with Michael.
He saw to extend himself into the zoosphere in ways that other people don't.
Yeah, he sort of takes over the zeitgeist, you know.
And now with Marianne Porter starting her own little micro press.
Yes.
There are plans for all these little short, what they've been publishing are gems.
Yeah.
These wonderful little gems.
Well, there was a time when Jack Dann used to live in Binghamton, and he would come to Binghamton, New York. And he would come down.
We have to always
he would come down and visit me in Philadelphia, and Michael Swanwick was living in Philadelphia at that time. And we would all get together, and we would break out bottles of cheap wine, and we would all get drunk, basically. And then somebody would say, let's write a story. And so we ended up writing quite a few three-way collaborations, enough for a book of them. And we called ourselves the Fiction Factory, which was a big mistake because, you know, critics got a hold of this and belated us around the head with it. But
I can't see that your reputation or Michael's or Jack's has really suffered. Might have felt so at the time.
Well, John Clute thought it was déclassé of ourselves to refer to ourselves as the Fiction Factory, I think. But
well, that's because he had to put it in the encyclopedia. He wasn't pleased with the representation.
So, yeah, we did a lot of stories. Usually one person would have the idea, the other would elaborate it, and the third would not necessarily write it, but shape it and polish it and give it its final.
I have somewhere a recording of George Alec Effinger complaining about, they all come up with this idea and they left me to write it. So...
Well, actually, I did write a novel with George Alec Effinger called Nightmare Blue, which was a not particularly good novel. Honest pot boiler is about as much as you can say on it. And that, again, was I've never actually sat down and written a novel all the way through in one shot. What happened with Nightmare Blue was that I had written this short novel, which really sucked, and I was living in New York with George Alec Effinger was also living a few blocks away, and we were both dirt poor. And I said, well, I've got this novel manuscript. So he said, well, let me rewrite it and we'll sell it. And so he rewrote it. And then I had to rewrite it again, and we eventually sold it to Dave Hartwell, and it actually got printed. So they've all been strange, the origins of my novels. They're not straightforward at all.
Well, I'm hoping that each of you will be more prolific soon.
It's not hard to be more prolific than me. At least as far as short stories are concerned. Now, I've done lots of anthologies. I've got like 140 books or something at this point as an editor. But,
yeah, no, that's certainly an amazing record. And they're really worthwhile. Let me also mention that as a person who, for many, many years of the beginning of Hour of the Wolf, I would choose a topic on how to do... You know, what am I going to do this morning? Warlocks, dinosaurs, whatever. And Gardner had this whole series
with Jack Dan, yeah.
That I'm just saying the names of the books. Warlocks, dinosaurs, unicorns. They each had
magic cats.
Bunnies. No, we never got around to bunnies.
Oh, look, kittens.
Datlow. the not kittens with Datlow. It's like
carnivorous zombie moths.
So it was like having an index right there. It's like, okay, this is I can pull that out and say, okay, this morning on the air we're going to discuss such and such, and I had the table of contents to talk about the writers. These were great anthologies. They still are. There is a
deal in the works to theoretically, potentially, get all of those out as e-books.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Those are great. They're, I mean, all the edited stuff that you've done is fantastic. Anthologies used to be really boring. You'd go to them, and they'd be full of these dead stories. And then Gardner started doing anthologies, and all of a sudden, they're reprint anthologies. Just these fantastic stories that he's dug up while they're still screaming and rising.
They were jammed them in there.
They were collections, and they, in the best sense of the word.
Yeah.
And
well, my
curated.
My secret is very simple, and everybody thinks I have some elaborate didactic mechanism that I use to make these selections, and you know, they're very disappointed when I tell them that I don't. If I like a story, I put it into the book. You know? If I don't like it, I don't. You know, that's basically...
The secret is out.
Basically, all there is to it. And I think I'm an ordinary enough reader in my tastes that I can be moderately confident that if I like something, that a decent percentage of the rest of the audience is going to like it too. And that's really been the secret of my success as an editor. It was true at Asimov's too.
Yeah. Well, we need to start wrapping up.
Well, okay.
But I can't thank you both enough. When
sure you can. Start now.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I got 3 minutes for it. Just, thank you. And oh, by the way, that was really cool. Thank you. Eileen, about when do you think you might be turning in pages?
The manuscript?
Yeah.
Boy, that's really hard to say. Because the story, I never know. Stories, even after they're finished, last a long time in my outbox before I send them out. And then I'll look at them and I'll change them and I'll tweak them. And then I'll send them out and then I'll grab them back and tweak them a bit more. So the novel, I have no idea, but I do know that Michael Swanwick is sending me an email every day with a new quote in it that he's modified to encourage me to get to work on the story. And, you know, at some time I'm going to have to just give in and finish the book and send it out.
Do you have a cat?
No.
Oh, too bad. I was going to say, if you had a cat, Michael could kidnap it and threaten to torture it if you didn't finish your...
Put it into the coffee roaster, yeah.
If I finish...
Send you an ear every once in a while.
I was going to say, if I finish the novel, but when I finish the novel, I will be very grateful to Michael. He also gave me the idea for the novel. Ooh. So he's like an instant idea machine. He gave me the idea and said it was a short story and I could have it done in 3 months. And I thought, I can't write a short story in 3 months.
At some point, either in person or by phone, we're going to have to do a secret roast. Where we're just going to record a whole series of interviews roasting Swanwick,
yeah.
And then present it to him as a completed product.
Michael is amazing.
I can see that that people in here in Sofwa are going to be seeing.
Michael is amazingly...
The conspiracy has started.
Michael's amazingly creative. I mean, I'm hardly creative at all, but Michael is constantly doing something creative. Like, he writes stories on leaves and leaves them lying out in order in the park, you know. I mean, He writes stories in bottles and seals them away, and nobody ever reads them.
You can read the outside, but you can't read the end of the story because it's curled up in the bottle.
I mean, you could leave me in a room for 400 years, and I would never do any of this stuff. So,
He says that he trained himself to do it, to just generate idea after idea after idea. And I know from advertising that you can do it, but I have no idea how to do that at the short story level or the novel level.
Anybody who can turn the table of elements into a series of short stories.
Yeah, another example.
Yeah. Or not, my favorite Michael Swanwick work like that is The Sleep of Reason, based on Goya. I published it in The Infinite Matrix in, 2003 or something. And he wrote that during the beginning of the Bush presidency. And it's a political satire. It's also a larger satire. And it represents Goya immensely well. It's amazing how Goya's sequence of 80 drawings could be transmuted into a parable for 2003.
Whereas if you locked me in a room and said, here, write a series of stories about the elements in the periodic table and we'll give you this $1 million, I would still be sitting in there, you know, and $1 million would be perfectly safe.
No, you start with gold, work your way from there, you know.
Oh, while you're all running out in a buying frenzy, my brand new Best of the Year anthology, 29, should be out any day now.
I know the reviewer's copy is out.
Ah. Well, thank you. I'm going to...
Well, thank you, Gardner and Eileen. This was fabulous.
Thank you, Jim.
Actually, I have to piss, so I'm going over here.
Oh, do you want to...
Well, there go Gardner and Eileen walking out of the room at last year's Nebula Awards just about a year ago. What were you saying about BioShock, Max?
I was saying, if I ever finish Skyrim, it's the next game on my list.
Yeah, I couldn't get started on Skyrim.
Well, you got to get past the opening.
Well, that's the problem. Is
there's a dozen walkthroughs online that tell you how to get through. I had trouble with that one scene, and after that, everything else is very simple.
I'll do that eventually. I mean, there's this physical thing where you have to, where the building is on fire, and you have to follow.
You have to find the
people.
Exit, which is hard to do.
But I found the exit. But then you have to jump over a fire thing.
Once you've done that, the game, everything else is fairly straightforward.
Yeah, but it's like trying to get past the boss level in Diablo 3.
Right at the beginning.
No, at
two. Just to start the game.
But this one is right at the beginning. And so, I've really...
That's the only obstacle in the game, really. Everything else is straight ahead, straightforward. And if it isn't, there are enough user-created content sites... better quest objectives is one that, writes out much more clearly than the sort of subtle clues you might get as to what your next objective is.
Yeah, I mean, I played Morrowind all the way through and all the add-ons.
The latest add-on for Skyrim takes you back to a Morrowind, which island? Somerset? No, somewhere that you get to go opens up an entirely new area.
Damn it, I miss Ultima. And I don't mean Ultima Online. I miss the Ultima games.
Well, you know...
They were so clever.
Someone was porting over Ultima 4, I think, for the Dungeon Siege engine.
Oh, really?
And they were doing it in chunks. So you could, I have parts of it. I don't know if it was finished the last time I looked. They were still working on parts of it. But, I mean, it puts that world into a more or less modern game setting.
I want it on my tablet, damn it.
Well, take a look. Maybe it's there. I haven't looked into it for a while. I don't think so.
Tablets are not yet a good gaming platform. And most everybody does everything for the iPad first and then Android later, even though Android is now outselling iPads.
The last use for the desktop will probably be gaming.
Well, that's the thing. That's why the desktop will never fully go away. As long as gaming is powerful, Alienware... will, you know, which is now owned part of by Dell.
Yeah. But with the i3 and the i5, you know, do you really need?
You need an i7.
Well.
No. With, you know, you don't need Alienware. No, you don't. No, if you get an i7, 12 gigs of memory, and you're set.
Well, Skyrim, I got an i5.
Oh, and a good and get a very good graphics card.
I have not done. I don't think I've upgraded the graphics card, but it works fine anyway.
Yeah, no, you it works fine, but it can be very, very cool with a better graphics
especially
card.
Especially because the only cheats I download or user, you know, content is like better trees. Better grass, better flowers.
Yeah,
better sounds in the dungeons.
I did that for a while with The Sims, where I was taking various mods and putting them on there.
The only cheat mod I have is a spell that you use called Blink Teleport.
Yeah, okay.
Which gives you the ability to basically anywhere you can see on the horizon, you can teleport yourself there.
Mm-hmm.
Just by hitting your button.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So, you know, you can get yourself into trouble with it, but you can also get out of trouble with it. You know, sometimes you get stuck and you can't move out of an area. This will get you anywhere that you can see.
Yeah. Speaking of which, by the way, no, there's no sign of Lister yet, is there? Wait a minute. Is that somebody at the door? The second panel down, we have these monitors now.
Unless he went to
that's right. No, that's right outside here.
Yeah, no, there's no one at the door.
Okay, yeah.
But he used the secret entrance last week.
Yeah. No, I can see where the door is. There's no monitor in the secret entrance, is there?
No, but you can see the hallway. So if he's in the hallway, you'll see him in the hallway.
Ah, yes, you can see the hallway.
Yes, yeah.
I hope everybody watching their radios can see what we're looking at.
It's the 1984 radio station here. We have 16 cameras around the facility in the hallways.
We actually have, yeah. It's quite true. And we really, by the way, should be putting a webcam in the control room here.
Oh, well, Robert was screaming about that very thing. There is one right there, and it's on. You're online right now.
I am.
Yes, so it's at what is that?
On Ustream.
Yes, it's on Ustream.
Really? I'm gonna have to look that up.
Apparently, though, after a minute or so, it just stops working. You have to keep reloading it. But BAI's studio is on Ustream right now.
Okay, Ustream.
So stop picking your nose, Jim.
Ustream is okay. I watch birds on Ustream. Very specifically, I'm watching now some baby red-tailed hawks.
Oh, okay. I watched some baby owls a year or two ago.
But right now the cool thing are the baby hawks up at Cornell University. And also, and this one is really cool, but this is on something called Livestream, hummingbirds.
Ooh.
Baby hummingbirds.
I mean, you barely see them. Just flying around.
You can, and it's got audio. So whenever mama comes into the nest, you hear all of a sudden, you hear just for a second.
Yeah.
And then she feeds them with that, you know, she's got like a 2-inch beak. Her entire length is about 2.5 inches.
So why do we see no hummingbirds in New York, but if you go north?
You do.
You do? I've never seen any until up north. I've seen them.
Okay, they have been spotted in my part of Brooklyn. And
you got parrots in your part.
No, that's Midwood.
Oh, okay.
That's where another WBAI programmer who has my former time slot.
Yes.
Lives. There are parrots there. They're great. But no, there are...
I've never been there in the daytime, so I've never seen them.
I have. They're great. They're wonderful. But if you will see hummingbirds if you have a proper hummingbird feeder.
Because
hummingbirds need...
They just need nectar, right?
They need tons of nectar. And they need certain plants that... which are very, very deep. That's why their beaks are so long. So things like that. So they can go in, they can get the nectar, but They also happen to like just plastic things with sugar water and nectar in it.
That's why I've seen them up north and all around.
Exactly. And if you put those out and, like, you know, put an ad on Google Plus or Facebook on the Hummingbird page, they'll say, oh, look, there's a feeder over there. And eventually...
Or you can just go to the wrong website and you'll get ads for hummingbird vines every day.
Yeah, there you go. There
body
you go.
Bags. FEMA buys thousands of body bags. Why do I get this
for
email?
Hummingbirds.
There's a couple of emails that I've just started receiving. I don't know what I clicked on, but my goodness.
I don't know. I mean, I was looking at the computer you're working on before, and boy, does that thing have spyware on it.
Yeah.
It really does. And some of it comes through legitimate companies.
And some of it, that particular one, I removed it. It's part of another program, and that's why you can't get rid of it.
It comes with that other program if you're not careful and click off the little check mark that says, do you want all of our junk?
Yeah,
and do you want stuff from our partners? And that's where you get screwed. If you don't unclick those things that say, I agree to get everything from every partner that you're going to sell my email address to.
This is why I can't join up for anything on Facebook, because they all want you to agree that they will post. They can post in your name. Hell no.
You can turn that off. Oh, on external sites. That's right.
No. Facebook, like, no, plugins. No.
Okay,
and whatever.
You can turn that off. But you know what? If they hide or change all the time where you turn off the privacy settings. Mm-hmm. But there is software out there that will basically check your privacy at all the various social media sites. It will go, it will check your account, and it will turn off all, or rather turn on all the privacy things, so they can't use your stuff at all. It will work for Google Plus, it will work for Facebook, it will work for Twitter. It's a very useful little app. I have it at home. I don't remember the name of it. I downloaded it a year ago, and I keep it updated, and it works great.
And what's it called?
I don't remember. You know.
Well, that would be a useful thing to know.
Oh, there's somebody at the door.
I'm not signing up for anything.
No, there's Lister.
That wants
there's
to
Lister.
Post. Is he in?
Run, Lister, run. Yeah, he's in.
Oh, okay. Here he comes.
He's running. He's running. Run, Lister, run. Run, run, run. See Lister, run. See Jane, run. Run, Lister, run.
Okay,
run,
he's on camera
run.
Three.
There he is.
He's moving
he's
to camera
three.
Four.
He's moving to camera four. He's in the control room. He's here. He's arrived. Happy Beltane.
Hey, thanks.
Yeah, right.
Thanks.
Yeah. This is two in a row. You're usually here an hour early, man.
Well, it takes 2.5 hours from Brooklyn.
Oh, for God's sake. We may have to work out my picking you up or something like that, because I am driving here.
You know, we'll be in Brooklyn soon enough.
So
the rumor mill says.
Yeah.
The Atlantic Avenue part.
The B in WBAI will stand for Barclay.
Yep, we'll be by the Barclay Center. So they say.
Well, that would be good for him and for me. Wouldn't be that good for guests. Actually, it is, because, you know, they have all these new shuttle buses going to Barclay and all that stuff.
Well, and most train lines go there. It's just a question of, will people get on the train to go there?
Well, more people will go there than go to CCNY, maybe. I don't know. I mean, this is a lovely area here, I must admit.
Yeah, so really it's just getting here that's the problem.
Yeah, exactly. Especially if you live in the south end of Brooklyn.
Just take a helicopter,
exactly, and then parachute down.
Blink teleport.
Yes, exactly. Oh, well, you've got that mod already, Max.
That's right.
So you should have no problem getting here.
Take the Max next
time. I am going to get off the bleeping air. I would like to thank Gardner Dozois and Eileen Gunn for that interview from a year ago. And yeah, we do have to do that thing with Swanwick. I have to tell listeners, I committed a Swanwick faux pas, where apparently they want to put up a plaque in Philadelphia for Isaac Asimov's home. And I wrote on a website, Media Bistro, I said, for Christ's sake, Asimov was a New Yorker. He's identified with New York and all that. And it turns out that these friends of mine, these really good people, Michael Swanwick and Steven Siegel and all that, are the people behind this movement. They said he lived in Philly for 3 years, and that's when he wrote Foundation.
Hmm.
And you should put up a plaque in New York. There's no reason you can't put one in New York. And somebody else said, rightfully so, this is like saying you shouldn't put up George Washington slept here in anywhere but Virginia.
Yeah.
And there was a point. Well, so Michael, I know you're not listening, but sorry about that. Everybody, I expect to see you on Tuesday at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, where Evie Manieri, and Liana Renee Heber, two lovely, wonderful writers, and Liana is a performer. Her readings are great. I'm going to be meeting Evie for the first time. We'll be there. It's at 138 Sullivan Street. If you want to know more, go to ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, or look up the reading series, the NYRSF, NYRSF readings on Facebook. Okay, stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister coming your way. I'm not playing Sales of Silver. I'm playing Thomas the Rhymer because it's a Beltane song. So here it is. And again, everybody, thanks for listening. I'll be back next week begging. And when I say begging, I mean we'll be begging. Good morning.